I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hi, everyone. It's Vic here. Just a note that in this episode, we do cover some hard-hitting topics, including rape and sexual violence.
Coming up on Vic Shelfie.
If you want to be taken seriously, don't on ACAR, don't be feminine, don't show your body, don't, you know, it's like that was my rules. And then suddenly being put into the celebrity world, it was like, wear a bikini clothes, wear all makeup. And it felt like suddenly I was trying to achieve a whole new set of rules of what being a successful woman looked like. Nothing made me feel older than opening this book and realising that the pages are yellow. It looks like something you find in a vintage shop, and it was all new. And I remember my brother and sister saying to me, you have to tell mum and dad that you're going to be on Men Child C. I think it was like a week before, and then I actually got a tell them. And when I said, I'm going to do a wig Chelsea, my mum was like, would you not be better on Geordie Shore? And I'll tell you what, guys, every time I say piles of prolapse on social media, you do lose a lot of the annoying men in that. So really, I went to it.
No, it is.
Hello, I'm Vic Hope, and this is Bookshelfie, the podcast from the Women's Prize that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the five books by women that have shaped them. Now, before we begin, remember to subscribe or follow so you never miss an episode, with thanks to our sponsor, Baileys. Today, I'm joined by Ashley James. Ashley is a broadcaster, author, DJ, and advocate who first appeared on our screens in the early days of Made in Chelsea back in 2012, and has since gone on to be a feminist campaigner and social commentator. Her popularity spans major networks and channels, including her regular role for ITV's This Morning as political and social affairs correspondent. She also appeared in Channel 5's all-female Celebrity Big Brother Year of the Woman series in a salute to a centenary of women's suffrage, and Celebrity Mastermind, where her specialist subject was 19th century suffragette Lady Constance Lytton. Praised by Carol Vorderman for being a difficult woman, what an accolade.
Yeah, Carol.
Ashley is widely known for her quick wits and authenticity on social media, and uses her platform to discuss topics including equality, social justice, and feminism. Her debut book, Bimbo, which is over here, and it looks lovely on our table, was published earlier this year, a number one Sunday Times bestseller. Whoop! Bimbo has been described as a rallying cry for every woman who's ever felt too much or not enough. Covering the many themes of feminism and the labels that box women in. I should say we're coming to you live from Baileys HQ in London, our lovely Bookshelfie sponsors. So please join me in welcoming Ashley James.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, I know it's always a bit of an awkward one listening to all the accolades and everything you've done in the intro. How's it feel?
It's so weird listening to yourself being introduced, because I feel like you'd only really ever have that at your funeral. Do you know what I mean?
And you're alive, Ashley James. You're
alive.
Well, let's start with Bimbo. It was published in February. How does it feel to be a debut author, to have put pen to paper?
Do you know what? It actually feels amazing. It's probably one of the, I was going to say the scariest thing I've ever done. The scariest thing I've ever done was definitely Celebrity Mastermind.
It is that chair.
Have you done it?
Yes.
I cannot believe it. I said to Nick Ferrari, who I do This Morning with, I was like, have you done Celebrity Mastermind? He was like, I would never do that. It's too scary. And that made me feel better.
Yeah, that's it. I revised for like 2 weeks for that. Solidly.
I remember getting to the hotel night before and everybody was like, well, there's something more you can do now. And I was like, I haven't been started. I'm going to have to swat up. I felt like university again. There's always more we can do.
Yeah.
But I did well, not on the general knowledge, but the important thing was I did well on Lady Constance Lytton. But I was writing Bimbo at the time. But it's such a weird thing because I always wanted to write a book, but I didn't really know what it would be about. And then, you know, I think when you write a book, you have these moments where you're like, this is going to be amazing. Oh no, this is going to be terrible. Oh people did an art list, and I've read it probably about 7 times towards the end, being like, is it good? Is it good? And I got friends to read it. So then I remember when I was waiting for my publisher to tell me if it was going to be Sunday Times bestseller, because I made the mistake of like making it really obvious that it was my ambition for ego, but also because I really believe that people should read it. And it's the book that I wish I'd had when I was a teenager, or when I was single, feeling like I was swimming against the current of kind of the outdated expectations, but also when I was a new mom and I felt really isolated and like I guess like I was failing at it. And so when they rang me, I actually ignored the call because I was too nervous, but then I sat down and then I answered. And when they said it is number one, I was just like, oh my God, amazing.
What an incredible achievement for your debut. What have you made of the reception beyond the figures, but more the things that people have told you about how it made them feel?
Yeah, I think that's the best thing about it, because every single day I get messages from people and it's received how I was hoping it would be received. And, you know, it's like people of all ages. It's men who are like, I wish I'd had access to this sooner. Like, I can so understand my wife more, or my daughter and what she's going through in adolescence. So that's really nice. But yeah, it's just... I guess it's like the book that one day I want my son and my daughter to read, and hopefully so that women don't feel like so small and so shrunken, and that they find their voice sooner than I found mine, but also so that they don't feel like a lot of... I feel like even though they're all very different, a lot of our struggles are universal, and actually it's structural, but we're made to feel like it's us. So the reception is the best thing about it.
Well, in Bimbo, you pose the radical question, what if we, as women, stopped trying to be acceptable and started being free? So I'd love to ask, what does freedom look like for you?
I think freedom means being who you want to be and not who you feel like you should be. So it's living outside of diet culture and beauty standards. And by the way, I'm a work in progress, and I talk a lot in the book about my own contradictions, like recognizing that the aging industry is terrible and women aren't allowed to age, but yeah, I get Botox. So I'm not speaking from a pedestal. I'm speaking as like a real human being. But it's learning to be you and learning to not try to be like a good girl or a good woman, because what I've realized is you can't be good because the expectations and standards are impossible to meet, because you're either a slut or a prude, or you're like, when it comes to motherhood, I mean, child-free women and mothers are often pitted against each other, but even as mums, you're a working mum or a stay-at-home mum, and both are kind of judged. So it's just learning to live outside of the rules and to stop judging each other by rules that actually don't serve us at all.
You said that this is a book that you wish you'd had at certain times in your life, when you were younger, for example. We're going to talk about the books that you did have that helped you in some way, that helped shape you. And we were just saying before we came in, reading is hard at the moment. I've just had a baby as well, and we're co-sleeping again. There is no time when I can have the light on. So we've got the little torch on the phone under the cover. When do you do most of your reading?
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? And do you know what? When I'm in a book, I will find that time to read anywhere. Like, I'll read anywhere. But then I get like a bit of book mourning when it comes to the end. And then it takes me a while to get back into a new book. And then I'm like, don't have time, don't have time. But actually, if I'm reading a book, like, I literally don't want to do anything else, I'll be like reading in between anything. But I'm not co-sleeping anymore. So I try to read before bed, although I typically last about one page before I fall asleep. I woke up the night of the BAFTAs. I was staying in a hotel, so I had this little reading light, and I woke up until the morning. I had why is it so bright? And it's because I'd fallen asleep with my book in my hands. No, it's a really bright reading light on. So yeah, I do my best, but I'm much slower than when I was at uni or school.
But it is the best feeling being inside it, inside one of those books that has you racing to the end, but then has you bereft when it's over. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the books that you have loved so, so much. Your first book, Shelfie book, is The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. And I should also say, Ashley is an excellent student and has brought all of her books today. So we can hold up, where is it, amongst the pile. There we go.
Can I also just say that nothing made me feel older than opening this book and realising that the pages are yellow. It looks like something you find in a vintage shop, and it was all new when I was 17 or 18. So that made me feel really old today.
It means you have lived in those pages, Ashley. The multi-award-winning dystopian classic follows Ofres, a handmaid in the Republic of Gilead, a religious totalitarian state in what was formerly known as the United States. She's placed in the household of the commander and has only one function, to breed. If Ofred refuses, she will be hanged. Yet even a repressive state cannot eradicate hope and desire. As she recalls her pre-revolution life in flashbacks, Ofred must navigate through the terrifying landscape of torture and persecution in the present day, and between two men upon which her future hangs. Masterfully conceived and executed, this is a haunting vision of the future from the multi-Women's Prize-nominated author and has been adapted into an equally successful Emmy Award-winning TV series. So you said you were about 17, 18 when you read this book. Studied it?
Yeah, my A-levels.
And you described it as initiating a feminist awakening on how political women's bodies are and the fragility of women's rights. Talk to me about the impact this book had on you.
Yeah, so I studied literature, and I went on to study literature at uni, but I feel like this is the first book that kind of put into words how I unknowingly felt as a teenage girl at an all-boys school, where, you know, there was a real hypocrisy and double standards around our freedom, our sexuality, the way we expressed ourselves. And I remember reading this book and finding out that everything she wrote in it had happened somewhere in the world. And I think it might have been the first time I discovered what the term dystopia meant. And I was like, this is just such an amazing concept. But it was the first time I'd really considered how politicized women's bodies are. And I think back then, I very much believed, like, aren't we so lucky to live in the West and to be living in a period of progress? And it's funny now, because obviously the book has since become a series, as you mentioned, and so many people now know to talk about this book. And it feels now less like a dystopian nightmare and more like a warning and a reminder of how fragile our rights are. So I feel like it's really grown with me as my own understanding of feminism and politics has developed, and a reminder that we can't be complacent. So I just love, that's why I picked it, because it was like from when I was 17 and now I was a 39-year-old woman, it's kind of stayed in my heart.
What was your early engagement with feminism? What did feminism mean to you when you first encountered it?
I talk about this in Bimbo, but I would say that my first thought of feminism was well, that's not me, because I shake my armpits and I don't smell of hemp. And, you know, I had this real, like, I'm not a feminazi. Like, and I was very much someone who had a lot of internalized misogyny, because it was survival so just to context, I went to an all boys school. I was 14 when they started allowing girls, and it is very male dominated. It was a boys rugby school. It was very much an environment where boys will be boys and girls learn to stay in line and to behave like ladies. And that's something I talk a lot about in Bimbo. And so I didn't identify as a feminist, and yet I knew I felt angry at the different standards and what was acceptable for men. And I fought against that, but I didn't understand that that was early feminism.
Where did you think you would have started calling it feminism?
I think towards my late 20s, okay. So I became single at 27, which I feel like is quite a pinnacle time in a woman's life to become single, because so many of us have these invisible timelines and, you know, we kind of expect, or you start expected to be married and have babies and all of those things by my late 20s. And suddenly I was single in my 20s. And I think You know, I talk a lot about body image and bimbo as well, and having big boobs and navigating the idea of beauty and brains and being taken seriously, and, you know, all of the discourse around my body and the sexualization around my body, and really craving being taken seriously and trying to navigate all of that. And then being single and feeling like I was swimming against the current and trying to find happiness as a single woman and trying to prove that I had value outside of my relationship status. I think that's when I was like, I think I'm a feminist.
I think I might be.
But again, I talk about this in Bimbo. I was a feminist and I loved it. Also, I went on to Celeb Big Brother around that time and it, for the Year of the Woman. But I realised once I became a mum how much internalised misogyny I had against motherhood. So I think that's why I say motherhood radicalised my feminism.
Mm. You've actually taken so much from The Handmaid's Tale. What you said there about that dystopia feeling so close to our reality, it's never felt truer. We've seen women's bodily autonomy being rolled back around the world. Progress is never won, and sometimes it feels like it's slipping through our fingers. How high are the stakes right now?
I mean, they couldn't be higher. I think for all of us, we look at what's happening in the USA, especially growing up. Like for me, USA, it was like the American dream. Not to mention, I always had family in the US, but I remember we'd go there and everything would be like half price. It was literally like the best place ever.
Bigger.
Yeah. But and yeah, I remember it was just like a really exciting time. I feel like I remember when like Barack Obama became president, it was like, wow, we're living in progress. How cool is this? And the reversal of Roe versus Wade, I think, was such a wake-up call for all of us. And even, you know, we had the local elections recently, and seeing what so many elected councillors have said about women and other groups of people, we're like, how are we living? Like, how is this the present day? And suddenly Gilead feels like very, very close. And part of what Margaret Atwood writes about is how it's such a slow movement towards this authoritarian state.
There's nothing in that book that we haven't actually already seen before, and that's the truth of it. She wasn't just pulling it out of thin air. And we have to remember, you actually have a series on Instagram where you dress as a handmaiden in the now iconic red cloak. And you highlight the ways in which women's rights are under attack in society. Going from that and from talking about The Handmaid's Tale with me tonight to, say, appearing in Made in Chelsea, it's like a cultural whiplash. Did reality TV change how you thought about your identity? You keep saying about wanting to prove yourself and say, actually, this is what I talk about, this is what I know. How do you reflect on that time?
So, I mean, it kind of fits in with the next book, Anieno's Le Plaques, which I've just planned out the English name for and I've forgotten. But when I did a Made in Chelsea, I was 25. And I've left school. I've always been a high achiever and a perfectionist. And I've always really strived to be a good, high achieving girl and then woman. And I remember when I quit my job at 25 with a dream to get into television. I didn't have any contacts, and I remember quitting my job, doing TV presenting course, which was Monday to Thursday. And on the Thursday, a friend of mine who I made on the course, who I'm still friends with, is like, I'm going to be an actually made Chelsea, do you want to come? And I looked up at the production company and I saw that they also hosted the BAFTA red carpet that Fern Cotton hosted, and I was like, I can do that. So I said, well, I'll go on and I'll introduce myself and I'll tell them that I want to be a presenter. And then they were like, basically, do you want to come again? Do you want to do reality TV? And at the time, my friends all loved Made in Chelsea. I was a QI countdown kind of girl. And I made the same thing about, probably because I thought I was like too cool to like mainstream things back then. But I was like, I didn't want reality TV. But I was like kind of went with it because I was like, how funny that they'll see me once on the show. And then obviously it kind of just grew from there and I got an agent. But as we'll talk about with the next book, it really heightened a lot of my own insecurities of being from like a different class background and feeling like I didn't really belong, I guess. And it also ripped up all the rules that I was taught at school, which is if you want to be taken seriously, don't make up, like, don't be feminine, because if, like, don't show your body, don't, you know, it's like, that was my rules. And then suddenly being put into the celebrity world, it was like, wear a vegan clothes, wear all makeup. And it felt like suddenly I was trying to achieve a whole new set of rules of what being a successful woman looked like.
When in fact you can be both, you can be everything.
Yeah, it took me a long time to get to that realization. And I'm sure so many people relate to that, feeling like they have to fit into a certain box to be taken seriously as a woman.
Which I think is more convenient for the others than it is for us. And like you say, it resonates hugely in your second book, Shelfie Book, which is La Place by Annie Ernaux. This is a deeply reflective memoir in which Annie Ernaux examines the life of her father after his death, tracing his journey from rural working class poverty to running a small cafe and grocery shop in Normandy. Through restrained, almost documentary-style prose, Ernaux explores the emotional distance that education and social mobility created between them. The Boo becomes both a portrait of one man and a wider meditation on class, memory, shame, and the cost of moving between social worlds. And in English, it's a man's place. Tell us about how you came to read this book.
So when I was at university, I studied English and French literature. And in my French literature, I came across this book, La Place. And it's the first time I've ever seen anyone write or talk about the alienation, I think, that is a part of social mobility. So I got a scholarship to a boarding school when I was 8 years old, and my older brother had also won a scholarship. So he was the first person in my whole family line that had ever studied past GCSEs. And I suddenly found myself kind of straddling two class systems. My parents, my mum's a hairdresser, my dad's a farmer. They live in the Northeast, really hardworking people. And then I found myself in a school where I was the only girl in my year to not have a title. And I had to write letters every Sunday. And it's funny because my parents still have that on all the envelopes. It would say, Lord and Lady of... So I obviously had a complex that I didn't have a title. Which kind of like speaks to the kind of environments I was living in. And I very much felt, again, going back to this idea of wanting to be a good girl and wanting to please people, that there was one set of like rules of being normal at school and then one set of rules for being normal at home. And I really felt my dad's embarrassment, I think, of my different accent, because my parents speak the Geordie accent. My dad and my sister and I laugh because I remember once, so he was in a supermarket and bumped into his mates and he was like, yeah, move it. Yeah, yeah, it's not bad. And we were like, daddy. And he literally pretended that we weren't his. And you know, there were so many almost like comedy occasions where I'd open the fridge and be like, oh my God, it's amazing. We've got a pate. And dad was like, go off, my cool beef man. And I just never really had anyone vocalize this feeling of the more you progress. So Annie, I know, talks about that basically she changed social class through education and marriage. And whilst that usually is like rewarded and praised in society, there's this kind of idea that you never quite feel like you belong in either, but also you know, you might have very different political opinions suddenly to the people that you grew up with. Your accent's different, and trying to navigate that feeling of being really proud of where you come from, but also not quite identifying with it anymore. And the idea of normal just seems so different. Another example, at school, we were told to address all men, male adults, as sir. No titles for the women. And I remember going to the co-op home and the man serving on the till, I was like, thank you, sir. And my dad was like, will you stop it, man? It's embarrassing. And I was like, I'm so confused. I don't know, like, who to be. And obviously there was, like, natural teasing. But I feel like no one ever talks really about class like that. And it was a book that I actually remember thinking, I'm going to write a book like this one day. That, maybe that's what I'll write about.
It's so interesting. Your dad expressing embarrassment was you. So we're expecting you to say that you were embarrassed of him, perhaps in this new sort of milieu that you were operating in.
Well, I talk about this in Bimbo as well. And obviously it's like horrible to say, but when you're young and you're impressionable, I was embarrassed of them. I remember my dad would drive me to boarding school. He was a wagon driver as well on the side. Both their parents had two jobs to obviously pay for the education. And I think my parents were so, they really wanted us to have an education, to have all the things that they didn't have, because they both grew up on farms and both for various reasons had to leave school early. And so obviously they were like, education, that's what we want for our kids. But they didn't quite imagine that we'd come home in a, like, complete different world to them. And I remember when my dad would be going to a job in the wagon and he'd be like, wait, I'll get all this stuff in boarding school. And he'd drop my brother off and then me off. And I remember being like, oh my God, I'm nobody. And I'm pretty sure I can probably safely say that no boarding school person ever, apart from our family, has turned up in a wagon. So it was embarrassing. So then when I started making Chelsea, it kind of heightened that feeling of like, oh, and I hope no one discovers who I am. But it's same feeling a slight enormous guilt of like being really proud of my parents and really like grateful. And I really remember at uni being like, I'm hoping everyone meets them so that they don't hear their accents. And it's horrible, like it's so embarrassing as an adult to say that out loud. But obviously as a child, that was kind of my experience and it felt like this secret. And I remember my brother and sister saying to me, you have to tell mum and dad that you're gonna be on Main Chelsea. I think it was like a week before, and then I actually got to tell them. And when I said, I'm gonna be on Main Chelsea, my mum was like, would you not be better on Geordie Shore?
It's actually a very valid question geographically.
And dad being like, do they need Geordie Jeff to come in and fix everyone up? And then, yeah, I was like, Mum, if you knew Geordie Shore, I think you'd be very happy. Yeah, but obviously I'm now, as an adult, like very proud and grateful for everything that they've done. It's funny, if my kids do not understand a word that they say. And every time I talk about Brenda, I'll just go, where am I?
Do you still feel like you straddle distinct class backgrounds? Do you feel like it's impacted how you interact with people today, even?
I feel like it's now like a superpower that I've got to interact in different classes. And my cousin's a mixed race, and you know, she talks about, you know, that kind of straddling of like my auntie being a Geordie and her uncle being Indian and growing up in London, and that kind of similar disconnect, obviously different, like one's class, one's race. But I feel like living in these different worlds has given me a understanding of like a I guess understanding of feeling displaced in a very privileged way, that it gives me empathy for displaced people, or an understanding that actually there are struggles in every part of the world. But also I think because I've lived through snobbery, that it, I don't know, it just makes me feel much more empathetic.
This book is based in the 1980s. It's set in the 1980s. But do you think that an equivalent conversation has or is happening in the UK, the sort of experience that you're describing reflected back to you in mainstream British cultural discourse, especially right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about like our gran and grandparents, I'm very lucky that my gran is still around, but technology wasn't a thing when she was growing up. Like, you know, we have like political difference, we've got caste differences, but we've also, I mean, even when you get to what teenagers are going through now, it's so similar to Ian in that there was no manosphere, there was no really easy access to violent and online porn. You'd have to, not me, but you'd have to go to the news agents and go to Top Shelf. So it's just much less accessible and probably much less violent. And, you know, there's so many differences, I think, generationally, but I think class, we still don't really talk about how that shapes and isolates and creates like differences.
This episode of Bookshelfie is sponsored by Baileys. Baileys is proudly supporting the 2026 Women's Prize for Fiction, helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes.
Well, on the subject of the system and its ever-changing shape, your third Bookshelfie book is Fix the System, Not the Women by Laura Bates. In this explosive book, feminist writer and activist Laura Bates exposes the systemic prejudice at the heart of five of our key institutions: education, politics, media, policing, and criminal justice. Too often, we blame women for walking home alone at night, for not demanding a seat at the table, for not overcoming the odds that are stacked against them. This distracts us from the real problem, the failings and biases of a society that was not built for them. Combining stories with shocking evidence, Fix the System, Not the Women is a blazing examination of sexual injustice and a rallying cry for reform, inspiring the hashtag Hope United movement and becoming an influential bestseller in discussions around sexism and institutional inequality. Is that the first nonfiction book on your list? What made you gravitate towards it and what did you love about it?
I have to say, I feel like Laura Bates's mind, like she's so ahead of the times, and it was very hard to just pick one of her books. I remember reading Maybe Hayden. I remember reading about that in lockdown, so what would that be, 2020? And nobody is talking about a manosphere. And I remember people seeing me reading it and assuming it was like, oh, classic man-hating book. She's really good about man-hating. And I was like, no, it's about men who hate women. It's not man-hating. It's literally men who hate
the opposite.
So she founded the Everyday Sexism movement. Like, she has written another amazing book about tech and AI that I recommend people read. So it's very hard to narrow down one book, but this book, I think, makes us all realise that so many of our individual feelings of failure are systemic. And whenever I'm on TV and there's a topic that is anything to do with sexism, whether it's sexism in the police force or sexism in media and or language, that is the book that I'm like, what's Laura Bates said about it? And she is so stacked and research driven, and I just think she's one of the most impressive minds, and I think everybody should have to read her books, to be honest.
You described her books as clarifying. They made you see things more clearly. Like what?
So, for example, a really good example is how we talk about women in the media and how that normalizes the way we think and talk about other women. So I'm sure lots of us grow up thinking of a celebrity being like, I hate that person. Oh, she's so annoying. I hate her. But we don't know her. So why do we hate her? We hate her because of how the media have been talking about her. And I was having this conversation today with someone about how often we hate a woman who, I don't know, their partner could have done something horrible and she calls them out on social media. An example. And then the article will be about her calling them out. Right. And you're always like, oh, why don't you just shut up? Whereas actually there's no article on maybe like the guy who hasn't seen his children for a year. It's always on the woman. And the way I remember, there is all these articles about reading, like Ashley flaunts her toned physique. And then they cut a picture deliberately where I wasn't toned, and I'm not toned, but it's like they're doing it as they want people to be like, she's not toned. Or, you know, someone was showcasing their postpartum figure. Or if I ever talked about the higher sexualization of women's bodies, and as someone that has big boobs and has done since I was 14, and that kind of constant dialogue and sexualization of my body, the media would then find a picture of me from when I was a lingerie model and be like, Ashley bemoans her large breasts. And then instead of a provocative male gaze thinks from me in lingerie, so naturally everyone's like, oh, well, if she doesn't want people to look at her boobs, maybe she shouldn't be posing in lingerie. And it's all of that, that she makes you think, how have I not seen that before? that, like, everything. And that's just an example of media, but she is just so, she will change the way that you process information.
It's rage baiting, isn't it? It's pushing people's buttons. There's something about the word flaunt, and I only see it in those articles. No one's out there just flaunting. Like, what does that even mean? But it makes people hate you.
Showcasing your postpartum figure. Like, you're just having an ornament. Like, look at me showcasing my body.
Do you find having read this book that you're more armed for dealing with that onslaught that comes? How does it affect you?
It makes you just look at anything different. Like, for example, like we talk about victim blaming and sexual assault and how so often the victim's on trial, and she has so much amazing research on how it's not just as a society that we victim blame, but it's in, like, our judicial system. And I think I actually used this in my own book, that there was a case in Italy where a judge decided that a woman couldn't possibly have been sexually assaulted because she was in a public loo, didn't lock the door. Therefore, that could have been a sign of an invitation, even though she'd never met this person before. So she breaks down all of the different ways that the system is stacked against women and how women are often put on trial. And she just does it so brilliantly.
You talked about how much you admire the way Laura researches her work. What did the research process for Bimbo look like for you?
So the process of writing my book was very similar to how I did coursework at uni, which was spent ages doing research. So all the book, funny enough, I'd kind of semi-started writing a book in my single days. So I'd read all these different books that I was on my own journey of kind of unpicking and unlearning a lot of the societal views and standards that we have on success and our relationship status. And I started thinking, like, I might write a book about this. So I wrote loads of the quotes and stuff down, the pages of things that I thought I might want to talk about. So I realized at the beginning of Bimbo that I spent a lot of time reading and writing things down, and I like to physically write quotes down and put the page, and then I was like, I'm never going to write a book. So then I was like, right, don't need anything. If I need time to research, I'll do that after. And then I just free wrote everything. And I think my word count was meant to be 80,000 words, and I wrote 160,000. So then the second draft was basically me trying to then be like, well, what's just me writing about trauma and what's actually part of the book? It was very therapeutic.
I wonder how your editors felt.
I think when I said, I've written 160,000 words, expecting them to be like, that's amazing. They were like, well, that's quite long. But no, it was a process. And actually, it wasn't going to be Bimbo. And it was only when I was doing a second draft that I was like, I had an epiphany. And they were like, well, can we stick to it? I was like, no, this is going to be better. Trust me. So yeah, I'm probably a bit of a nightmare. I mean, I was a nightmare, even as far down to the cover of going to the Pantone chart and going into Waterstones and, like, looking at every single pink book and taking pictures to see what the perfect shade of pink was. Like, I was meticulous in every way.
When you were writing it and at some points thinking, I'm putting my trauma on the page here, what did you hope readers would take away from it? And has that changed since it has been in their hands since February?
Yeah, so I think what I wanted the book to do was to look at how language, societal expectations and outdated expectations shape our own experiences and make us feel small. And I kind of put the book starts in girlhood and goes into maidenhood, womanhood, singlehood, motherhood, and then elderhood. I'm sorry, keep that. I was like, what's a hood for aging? And I just wanted it to feel like there was a purpose for writing down trauma. And there were some things I was thinking, is this too much? For example, I speak about my own experiences of sexual assault, and it's something that I'd never really spoken about, not just publicly, but even in, you know, my close circles. And I thought, do I want this in, and is it relevant to be in, and am I comfortable with people knowing about it and talking about it? And I remember people being like, maybe you should just take it out because obviously it could get sensationalized, and how will you feel if articles are like rape survivor Ashley? And that did make me feel horrible. I was like, I don't really want to be that, and I don't want to be talked about. And also, I'm not a perfect victim because I never reported it. And I, you know, I basically ticked all the boxes of what not to do as a woman, because I'd been at a club, so I was dressed a certain way, I'd had alcohol, I didn't report it. And it was actually when I was writing, there was a lot in the news about Gisele Pellico, and she was just, or she is just, such a phenomenal woman, how she said, like, shame must change sides. And I thought, how can I write a book about shame but not include that because of shame? And actually, if and when my children read it, and if, God forbid, it ever happened to them or a friend or someone they knew, would I want that person to live with like this dirty secret as if it was their shame? And I was like, no, the only way this book can work is if I write about the shame and all of the reasons that would stop someone from coming forward or would worry about a victim blaming. And I remember speaking to Elizabeth Day saying, how do you know when you write a book what you should keep in? And she was like, if you're worried about it, keep it in. Yeah, that's what makes a great book.
That's excellent advice.
Yeah.
Well, on the subject of shame and guilt that perhaps we shouldn't be feeling, that is misplaced, let's talk about your fourth book, Shelfie Book, which is Matrescence by Lissy Jones. In this groundbreaking, deeply personal investigation, longlisted for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction in 2024, journalist and author Lissy Jones brings to light the emerging concept of matrescence, the profound developmental transition into motherhood. Through a blend of memoir, science writing, and social critique, Lissy challenges idealized narratives and shows how the changes in the maternal mind, body, and brain are far more profound, wild, and enduring than we had ever been led to believe. Matrescence has been praised for reshaping discussions around maternal mental health, identity, childcare, and societal support for mothers, and is seen as an influential text on motherhood, feminism, and structural inequality. Now, this is an amazing piece of work. You describe becoming a mother as transformational, as profound as adolescence in terms of transformation. Why do you think society still struggles to acknowledge matrescence as a major life transition?
Because it happens to women. I think, so I really struggled with motherhood. I should say, this is all in my book, but I was someone who thought I would be child-free, and I was child-free by choice. And then I found myself pregnant and it was lockdown, and I was like, I'm going to do it. As someone who is child-free by choice, I was always being told, you'll regret it if you don't, and you'll never know love like it, and all of these things that we tell women mainly who say they don't want children. So when I found myself in that situation against the backdrop of despair and death and destruction, it really did feel like fate that I was like, oh, I've got this like literally life and beacon of hope, and how bad can it be? Well, guys, it turns out really bad. And it was really traumatic. I love my pregnancy. Honestly, pregnancy, if I describe it for me, it was like, you know, Snow White walking around and all the animals come towards her.
Just whistling, they're whistling
yeah,
back.
I felt like Mother Nature has blessed me. Like, I loved my body. I felt like, look at me growing life. And I even loved seeing my body changes. I struggled, I'll be honest, with having my boobs grew 5 sizes, and that was hard as someone that already had big boobs. But when I had a baby, I loved that suddenly my boobs were this sexual thing, but it was like this, they had a purpose and a need, and they were feeding my baby. And of course, I should caveat, even though we should never have to, and say, I always loved my son. But I really felt like a almost like a freak of nature that I was like resentful that my life, all the things I thought would be bad about motherhood, really bad about motherhood. I was like, this is why I didn't want to have a baby, because this is exactly what I didn't want for my life. And it was like everything that I'd learned that about my identity and for me, what made me happy, I suddenly couldn't do. And it was like when lockdown opened at 6 months, I realized how much my life had shifted. And I really struggled with that shift. And then I thought, am I a bad mother, woman, that I don't have this like maternal, like I remember watching finger puppets. It didn't help every time I sang to them, you cried. And bear in mind, like there were nobody classes. It was lockdown, like you didn't meet my family.
So isolated.
It was really lonely. So at the time I was like, this is amazing. And I remember doing like finger puppets one day and being like, this time last year, I was DJing around the world at festivals, and now I didn't even know nursery rhymes at the time. I used to sing Mambo Number 5, so I'd be like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I was like, what is my, like, is this meant to complete us? Is this enough? And I felt a sense of regret. And obviously, it's a very tricky and nuanced topic that I speak in much more detail about in Bimbo. But I would Google, like, is it normal to regret motherhood? And what people always say to me is, what do you think your son will think when he grows up and one day sees you talking about this? And I always say, well, if he ever decides to have children, or his sister or his friends, hopefully he might understand what his partner or the women in his life might be going through. Because I think if men were the mothers and they were told their whole life, get a career, be successful, do all of these things, and suddenly you almost are expected to take this time out and kind of adopt this complete different personality and put everything on hold. And against, by the way, I should say, a system that doesn't really like value you and support you. And it was this real light bulb moment for me that I was like, oh my God, moms aren't just negative. It's actually like the system isn't set up for us to thrive. And I'd feel envious that Tommy could just go back to work and shut the door, whereas I was trying to work, but through breast pumping and, you know, all of those things. And you're exhausted. And my mental health, I think, would it be much better if there was more open discussion about the real identity shift. So when I heard the word adolescence, I was like, that's the thing that I felt like I was alone with. And it's this real thing that no one talks about, because everybody's worried that someone will think that you don't have your child. And I always say, like, if it wasn't for the love of my child, I'd have walked. Like, I was like, I'm not doing this, but I loved him. And I felt so guilty that I was feeling all of these things in my mind. And I think that's why this book for me is like transformational.
There's something so powerful about giving a word, giving language to a feeling that we've so quietly been dealing with, but not felt able to say anything about. I mean, for instance, the knowledge of that just feels powerful and helpful. And so many women will be experiencing early motherhood and beyond without that word, perhaps, and suffering silently, as we so often do. Why would you press this book into their hands?
I think because it looks at science as well. It's like, I had no idea that having a baby literally rewires your brain. And knowing that all of these changes and feelings aren't just you, it's hormonal, it's your brain being literally rewired. And I think there's so much guilt and this idea that you should be grateful, which of course two things can coexist. You can be so grateful, but also a lot of people, including myself in my first birth, I were recovering from what is quite a traumatic experience that, again, people don't really talk about. So it's like the physical silent recovery. Like, I will say I was looking forward to giving birth, because you know how people are always like, mother and baby doing well, and I was like, how could she be doing well? Like, she's either had a baby out that way or out that way, and neither of those made me feel like that would be well.
So I was almost like excited to be like, now I'll get to find out. Well, I was not well, and I still need a lot of surgery to deal with a lot of the physical problems that I experience with. But it's always like brushed aside, and you're like, well, don't scare. Like, you don't negative, or people are, you know, a positive story doesn't make a good story. That's why mums love to outdo themselves. No, it's not negative, but it's trauma. And I was really lucky that with my second birth, I'd have what we would describe as a positive birth experience. And I want that for everybody who wants to have children. And I think the more we talk about the, you know, lack of or underfunded maternity care, the better the system can be. And that silence, like with everything to do with womanhood, only really serves the system or perpetrators.
Let's talk about your fifth and final book, Shelfie Book, which is Yesteryear by Cara Claire Burke. Yesteryear follows Natalie, a glamorous trad wife influencer whose carefully curated social media life revolves around idealized domesticity, religion, and traditional gender roles. After mysteriously waking up in what appears to be the brutal reality of the 19th century, she's forced to confront the harshness behind the romantic pioneer lifestyle she once sold online. Blending satire, psychological thriller, and social commentary, the novel explores influencer culture, feminism, motherhood, and the performance of femininity in the digital age. This is a brand new novel. It's brilliantly challenging of the fantasy of this sort of traditional womanhood that I feel like we're seeing touted online so much now in a way that I never remember from before. Like, this feels like a new phenomenon. What made you want to pick up this book?
I just think it put into a story what I was feeling about the rise of the trad wife movement. That, again, because I love history, or specifically women's history, and so often we have not been written into history. And the more I learn, the more I'm like, our ancestors must be fuming that they worked so hard and relentlessly. I say in Bimbo that if I was born in the 17th century, I'd have been burnt at the stake. If I was born in the 19th century, I would have been put into an asylum. If I was born in the 20th century, I would have been in prison for wanting the right, and today I'm a difficult woman. When in life, there's just so many amazing women's stories, like Elizabeth Packard, who is an American woman who was institutionalized because basically she believed in that abolition of slavery, and because her husband was a pastor and he had a church, a lot of the billionaires were basically paying the pastors to not promote the abolition of slavery because obviously they benefited from it, and she became really vocal. And so he just put her in asylum because that's what we could do there. And while she was in the asylum, she was so troublesome because she was like getting all the other women to disobey, and they kicked her out. And then she realized that she didn't have the right to her house, to her children, and she fought for so many of like the marriage protections that obviously in America, but then that came into the UK. And I feel like it annoys me when I see this romanticization of the past or of the 1950s. Again, women who were working after war were then, they realized that there weren't enough jobs for men, so they kind of glamorized us getting back home. But, you know, we forget how recent so many of our rights are, even just like the right to leave, or the right, if that your husband rapes you, for that to be considered a crime, to have financial autonomy. Like, there's so many things. So when you see people promoting this romanticized traditional gender role, it's so problematic. It's not problematic, I get it. I think so many women are burnt out because of the world that we live in now, that actually for lots of people, the idea of being able to just be at home and live a slow life and be with your children, it is appealing. But we forget a lot of these influencers are making money by telling you to not work and to quit your job and to serve your husband. And at the same time, many young boys are being fed the manosphere and being told that, you know, a wife and a good woman should be submissive. And growing up, we were told, like, oh, get back in the kitchen, as if it was an insult. And now that the burn rate is declining, suddenly it's like, no, get back in the kitchen. And it's like, you can't just like undervalue like the traditional women's role our whole lives and then suddenly romanticize it instead of just giving us some rights and making motherhood more appealing or fixing childcare. You're suddenly like trying to convince us that this is our biological fate. So this book, sorry to say it, it basically, Natalie is a trad wife, and it's very clever that it shows that the cracks beneath her being trad wife, and one day she wakes up and she's in the 19th century? Oh, she's in the olden days. And so she suddenly comes to terms with the lack of freedom that women have. And it's so interesting.
Why do you think nostalgia for the past is so appealing to so many people at the moment? Why are people obsessed with it? Even when history tells very different story for women and otherwise. I mean, it was hard in the past. And people seem to overlook that when they have this yearning for it.
I think people have always romanticized the past. Like, you know, it's that cliche thing, isn't it? Of like your gran being like, back in my day, everyone believes that. Well, I mean, things were literally cheaper, so that is fair. But, you know, everything was better than the olden days, and you sort of forget the things that were really difficult. And I suppose it's a fear and uncertainty of the future. So, but you know, back when I was young, it was like computers or MSN Messenger that was going to be the downfall. And now for us, it's worrying about AI. And they all feel very real and very frightening because it's an unknown. And I remember growing up being like, I'm just so hopeless, it's romantic. And Michelle was born in the 1950s and men wanted to be with you. And when marriages lasted, the only reason marriages lasted was because we literally couldn't leave. Like, even if we wanted to, we could not leave. So we kind of conflate fantasy and romanticism with the past. And I think, again, because we're not really taught about the struggle and the fight to get our rights. I mean, the fact that we're talking about scrapping the Equality Act in Parliament is just unfathomable. And people are still voting for that. And this book yesteryear literally does what I'm like. I wish people could go back and realise what it was actually like so that they wouldn't just like flippantly give away our rights so we end up back in Gilead.
Well, it's this tension between fantasy and reality that sort of underpins the book. And Natalie's online persona is very much built around perfection and performance. We know that what we see on social media isn't real. It's important we keep reminding ourselves of that. But how do you balance the pressures of curating a public persona versus sort of normalizing the realities of your everyday experiences? Because that is what you do.
But I feel like I don't curate a fantasy, and I feel like I don't try to be anything other than what I am. What I will say is a lot of men especially are like, you're actually really nice in real life, but I feel like you're quite scary online, or you're quite a mad man hating online. But it's like that is everything I think, but I just might not bring up every time I meet someone. So, of course, it's curated in that sense. So I try to think of ways to make it engaging. Usually it's like, I have to bring out my Gilead outfit, yeah. So anyway, I can get voted for. But when I first got social media, I did feel like I had to project this sort of like perfect fantasy life where I remember, you know, editing every part of my face so I didn't have any, actually, I was just 2D. I actually edited myself so much, I looked 2D. And I just remember like editing my eyeballs so they looked really weirdly white. And, you know, you zoom in on every bit of yourself. And it was quite freeing when I was like enough, because the reason I felt like enough was because I started to hate myself in real life. And I started to worry that every person I met would realize that I wasn't the person that I was projecting. And in the real kind of epiphany mode for me, I think was like in 2015, there's a Victoria's Secret show, and I went online the next day and every woman that I followed was just like hating themselves, being like, oh, that's me not eating again. Or, you know, I was like, oh my god, what are we doing? Like, I don't want us to feel like that, and I don't want the next generation of women to feel like we have to zoom in on every single flaw. And that was when I started wanting to be more authentic and wanting to show myself. And actually, I always say the more you are yourself, the more you find your tribe. And I think that's true online and offline. And for me, the thing I love the most about online is like the like-minded community. And especially becoming a mom in lockdown, I didn't know any moms. I didn't have real life mom friends and I couldn't go to clubs. So people online were almost like my lifeline as well, because I knew that if there was anything wrong, then I could come to them. And also because I had all these different things that I was experiencing after birth, I was talking about it online. And I'll tell you what, guys, every time I say Carl's a prolapse on social media, you do lose a lot of the annoying men in that. So I'm really glad you went to it.
No, it is.
But it made me realise how many other people also had those issues, and therefore I could get advice, or I'd help people be like, oh, I didn't realise that women under 60 could get prolapses. I think I'd have got that. And so it's just nice to actually be more authentic and not feel like you're having to portray perfection.
Keep getting that bonnet out. I love it. And you're using, you know, your platform to educate, to inform. But what chapter would you like to pursue next in your story? Is there more writing on the cards? What's the future look like?
Yeah, I was just actually saying before, annoyingly, I have come up with a new book idea. And I say annoyingly because it really did take over my life. And I only just published it in February. And I came up with this new idea and I was like, oh, really not ready to write another book. But I have. I did make the mistake of telling money to be agent about it. And
then, oh, it's on.
So not yet, but that will hopefully come. I say I don't have like goals or 5-year plans. I just want to be happy. And I am loving like this stage of motherhood and getting to hang out with my kids. And I feel so lucky getting to do all different things that I get to do and get to call work. And, you know, even when I think back to that $25 who quit the job, and if you lived in a road jar for like 5 years, I'm like, we did it. Like, you know, even if it ends next year, like I did it, but I feel so grateful every day that now I get to have all of those things that make me happy. And I'm definitely in a period of life where like sisterhood, like hanging out with my friends is like the best thing in the world, and that makes me happy. And I just want to keep pursuing happiness, even if it looks different next year to what it looks like this year.
Well, listen, joy is radical, and that sisterhood is what we're all here for. That's what this is. So if we look through the sisterhood of authors who you've brought to the table today, the books that you've picked for your bookshelfie, which would be your favorite and why? Not that you would do that with sisters, that'd be very unfair, but so we'll take that metaphor away. Which of these books are your favourite?
I mean, I think it has to be The Handmaid's Tale, just for the impact that it's had on me as somebody like new, I guess, to literature and feminism, but also just the way the meaning has shape-shifted. What I will say, though, is I was so excited when the series came out, and I did watch the first series, but now I can't watch it because it's just too close to reality.
It is, yeah. Well, a lie has been lived in those yellow pages. And thank you for sharing your life and your favourite books with us tonight. And thank you so much to our audience here at Diageo, at Bailey's HQ. A round of applause for Ashley Chase. Thank you.
I'm Vic Hope, and that was Bookshelfie from the Women's Prize, supported by Bailey's and produced by Birdline Media. Thanks for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books that we discussed in our show notes. There's also a link to our bookshop.org shelf, where every purchase supports independent bookshops and the work of the Women's Prize Trust, a charity helping build a better future by championing women's writing. Now remember to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. And if you liked this one, then leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. I'll see you next time.